So the 19 path is what the three paths join the opposites together. And so it's one of those places where we look at the pull of opposites upon us. And we look at the genuine difficulty of staying balanced in life, in the world, in a world that is not balanced by and large. One of the things I want to look at with you really is to look at the chapter 18, which is about something the Hasidic masters call the strange thoughts. Now, they're not just thoughts, they're complexes of thought and memory and feeling that distort the whole dynamics of the tree and make themselves central. There's a root, Hebrew always comes out of triliteral roots, three letter words. And there's a word called devak, which the difficult thing about Hebrew, the letter bet in Hebrew is a combination of B and V. So you could say devak, you could also do devak, and the real pronunciation is something like devak. But it's strange to our kind of ears. So sometimes you'll hear that word being called debak or devak, but it's really debak. And that word means to adhere to stick close to join together with. It's formed out of three Hebrew letters. The first is the letter dalet, which is the door. The letter Beit, which is the house, and the letter Kof, which means the back of the head. And those three letters show something of the nature of this adhering to or sticking to. The letter Dalet is the doorway into something. The letter Beit is the house that we live inside. But the letter Kof suggests that this is something that happens underneath, happens at the back of the head. Now, in the Judaic mysticism, there is a word called devakut, which means the clinging to, the adherence to the divine. It's the Kabbalah's version of enlightenment, where you become so united to the divine, there is no distinction between you. And so that is one expression of devuk. So devakut is the union with the divine. But there is another world called devuk, which is the image of a devil which invades you and dispossesses your consciousness. And the quality of the devuk is that the letters are interesting in devuk, because what is added to devuk is that there's a doubling of the letter beit, which means the house of life becoming split and doubled, and then the letter vav is inserted, which is the letter that means a nail. It means something that, so you have this image of the devuk, where the house of life is split and something is nailed together that you cannot easily get free of. Now, this is the thing that the Hasidic teachers call the strange thoughts that we generate and obsess us and become central to us. And one of the problems really of holding any balance point and working with any sets of opposites is that the capacity to remain centered becomes distorted by the things that I've often called the idols of our nature, these strange thoughts that twist the whole dynamic of the tree. Now, this is the things that Jung would have called complexes, the combination of kind of thought, feeling, and memory that has an autonomous life, the way that, that it has become separated from the wholeness of our life, and is trying to survive, you know, because it is like all life forms, it seeks to survive and thrive and to grow. So the split aspects of our nature twist the kind of dynamic of the tree, pulling it in the direction of the message that's right at the heart of the strange thought. And strange, as I say, strange thoughts are quite primitive normally. They're normally about perceptions of the universe as being hostile and having to do certain things or be a certain way in order to live and thrive in the universe. And it's why, you know, in transformation, whether it's spiritually or in therapy, there's a whole process of being held steady while a process of deconstruction happens. And in a certain sense, in that original prayer that I use at the beginning, where we talk about Bethel is the house of God, the house, the terrible place of healing and sacrifice. Now the healing, the sacrifice that is involved in healing is the death of our beloved strange thoughts. And in a certain sense, the death of who we feel we are. It may be even the death of who we know ourselves to be. And the difficulty of transformation in some ways is this place where we have to be with and encounter things that we don't like, things we'd rather not be with. You know, you see that very vividly in the Merlin myth, where Merlin is dragged from one place to another, escapes to the greenwood, is brought back into the city, is chained up and has to experience certain things. In order that eventually, I mean, the great, I'm going to look at some details of the myth of Merlin this weekend because it's a good illustration of this kind of process. But you know what happens to, with you know, if we look at the whole myth of Merlin, if we look at the boy Merlin who encounters the corrupt king and who is building the tower, and the tower in a certain sense has to be entirely dismantled. You have to go down into the deeps, into the draining of the pool, into the experience of the two dragons, and through Merlin's witnessing of the dragons, his witnessing of the inner, you have this very powerful set of prophecies, that comes from the myth of Merlin, which arise because he, in a certain sense, is working with the energies of the white and the red dragon, and they are becoming united in his nature, and he is becoming sort of and the whole sort of that first part of the myth of Merlin is all about this process of deconstruction that happens, because what Merlin prophesies is everything coming to an end. It's an apocalypse. So there's a lot of the imagery is not very easy to understand now, but actually what we see happening in the myth of Merlin is the invasion of the Saxons and this war between the Saxons and the Britons, and we see all kinds of, you know, predictions of terrible things happening. The fish in the Severn will die. The churches will be empty. Will be emptied. And then at a certain point, we discover the goddess of the land appearing, and the old energies of the land happening, and then the goddess gets killed, and then the apocalyptic kind of energy moves into the cosmos. You start to see the planets losing their places, and in and And in the end of the vision of Merlin, what happens is the goddess Ariadne brings everything back into her womb. So it's a total sense of that sense of destruction, everything returning to the beginning point. And as I say, I'll come back to this in more detail later when we have a little bit more time. But what you see, what Geoffrey of Monmouth very cleverly does in his Vita Merlini, in his Life of Merlin, is having done everything is destroyed. Right towards the end of the Vita Merlini, you get a description of the creation of the universe, of everything flowing out of this mysterious place. So what is being looked at in this moment of this collision of opposites is destruction and creation. It's what you find happening in the Egyptian system as well. In the Book of Gates, you have this sense of the old and the dying sun who goes into the underworld, who has to wrestle and work with the energy of Apep, which is the energy of total inertia. And who is the sort of the dark shadow, really, of Amun-Ra. And as a result of this process of creation, destruction, working with inertia, eventually what happens is a new day happens, and the sun is reborn as the crowned and the conquering child Horus, who is made completely refreshed by that. So all these are kind of images or symbolic frameworks that talk about this process of descent and ascent, this process of healing and destruction. And in this way of understanding things, there is no healing without death. There's no healing without destruction. Merlin cannot become Merlin unless he participates in the total death of everything. Now, in the Vita Merlini, we learn that Merlin vanishes off into the forest because he cannot handle the awfulness of war, the awfulness of battle. And of course, that's an experience we all have when we look out into the world at the moment. We see all kinds of terrible things. But the answer, certainly as far as the Merlin myth is concerned, is okay, you've got to go more deeply into this. More deeply into that experience of death and recreation. And as that, you have to go right into the roots of things. So the false king has to die. The false sense of sovereignty has to vanish. The tower that is built on false premises has to fall down. We have to return to the great pool of life. But within that pool, we have to understand the dynamic of opposites. And only by entering into that play of dynamics do we reach the underneath of that, the place that is beyond opposites, beyond duality. And from that root, then something new emerges. But that emergence itself, that a prophetic emergence we find in Merlin, involves the destruction of everything that we know. So that it's a complete transformation. So everything we think we know dies. And we return, in a sense, into the beginning point, and from that beginning point, a new creation appears. Everything looks different, feels different, is experienced differently. And we are at not I, me, but we, the I that arises in that point is a nexus point, is at the service of that deep energy, and that has that shape-shifting capacity to be whatever is needed. And that's that whole thing about Merlin as the shape-shifter. You never know what he looks like. It's some of the very early teachings about Jesus. One of the very earliest church teachings about Jesus, not forgotten, is that he had to be kissed by Judas because nobody really knew what he looked like because his shape used to change all the time. Now that is that same capacity within us. Now the problem that we have in our lives is we have learned through the various strange thoughts that we've entertained, the things we've become literally stuck to, we've become stuck in a shape. that is predicated on past events. And therefore our shape-shifting nature, our deeper fluidity, our deeper ability to manifest that which wants to manifest through us is occluded by the rigidity of the shape of ourselves. And that rigidity is the thing that has to dissolve. So that's what we're going to look at these 2 days. Okay. So that's what we're looking at. Now you'll have noticed that in the meditation, really, the castle changes shape. Because what happens is that as we enter into these deeper places, as we enter into fluidity, the inner world responds to us. So the castle this time in the meditation was partly a medieval castle, partly a very ancient Celtic place, partly a completely abstract place. Because the tree really is this mirror. So this, as we enter into these deeper places, the images, the ways of experiencing are partly familiar, but partly completely unknown, and that's also part of the opposites that has to be worked with here somewhere. So what we're going to look at and keep looking at is this notion of divuk, this adherence, this stickiness, which is our capacity to stick to the known, our wish to stick to the known because it makes us feel safe. That is the root energy behind all of this. It's the desire to feel solid, unchanging, and contained and safe. It's a natural feeling. It's not wrong. But it's the root of all this occlusion. It's that literal stickiness where we would rather be in the constricted place that we know rather than the open place that we don't know. So at a certain point, whatever we talk today, whatever image reviews, it's this what we're really inquiring into is this capacity for stickiness and this root fear of openness. And the thing about the strange thoughts, which do distort things, is that in their inception, in their creation, they are helpers. They're helping us deal with something that was overwhelming. So the problem is that they didn't just dissolve when their moment was passed. So they become foundation blocks of our psyche, so that we recreate ourselves in terms of the dilemmas of the past rather than in terms of the possibilities of the present. And in a way, this apparently very simple thing, this idea of desire to be safe, the desire to stick to the known, it's the root of so much that goes on wrong in our world. It's the root of division. I stick to what I know. I know what I know. I like what I know. I won't entertain that which I don't know. That which I don't know becomes threatening, becomes evil, becomes dangerous, becomes I have to defend against it, maybe I have to attack it. Maybe I have to get rid of everything that feels different and alien in order to feel safe. Now that is the root of, we don't have to think far really into the world to see how much comes out of that kind of way of thinking. And in a certain sense, the more we can just simply understand our own aspect of that, the freer we become of it. And in that freedom, that sense of inner freedom, we enable the world to become a little freer of it. Because what we're looking at, in a sense, really, is how to re-establish what the Egyptians called ma'at, the balance point. So there's a great quality that the Egyptians have in their civilization, really, where you hope at the end of your life that your heart balances the feather of ma'at. The feather of Ma'at is the feather of truth, is the feather, it has this quality of lightness, that quality of being able to work with opposites fluidly. So that ultimately the flow of life, so the flow doesn't go on for too long, but isn't too little. So it's that razor edge. When we look at the sword bridge, we walk on that. That bear is a point of presence where we're listening and trusting that moment by moment movement of life. And ultimately, that process is a process of deeper befriending, of befriending all aspects, befriending the strange thoughts, befriending that which appears alien, so that as the stickiness dissolves, and as we start to see things as they actually are, rather than how our stickiness in this shows us, how we think they are, then we just make friends with everything. And everything, conversely, makes friends with us. Not in a simple way, not in a naive way, but in that deeper sense of what we might call universal solidarity, where we are one communion of beings, deeply interconnected at all the levels of our experience. Enough for now. Okay, I've gone a little bit over, apologies. So we're at 12:15. No, we normally go at 12.
It's confusing.
It's confusing as it's different online. Yes, it is. But we do normally go. I think it's also it's also confusing because I sometimes blur the boundaries because I'm in flow. So that's the other thing.
It's 12:30.
No, it's normally 12 when we hear it. I think it's normally 12 online as well, but I keep forgetting that.
No, but it's different. What is different today? I'm sure it's normally 12:30 here. Usually go over. That's why.
I think the problem is we do what's just happened, in that I get talking and I don't and I won't shut up really. So
I'm stuck between opposites here between Ian and.
Well, I had a question.